Well, hello again, and welcome to From the Center, the podcast of the Center for Western Studies. I'm John Hodges. I'm the director here, and I'm very glad you're here with us. Welcome back. Today, I want to talk to you about fairy tales. Fairy tales. I don't think our culture understands fairy tales much anymore. We hear people saying that teaching our children fairy tales leads them to be disappointed with reality. There really aren't handsome princes, so stop letting your hair down so he can climb up. Frogs don't become princes, so stop kissing them. There are no magic beanstalks that lead to castles and golden gooses, so stop swapping important things like cows for magic beans. There's a well-known musical called Into the Woods that interweaves the stories of all of the best-known fairy tale characters, and they all live happily ever after at the end of Act 1. But in Act 2, reality sets in, and I put quotes around reality. All of them run into terrible problems in real life, like, you know, raising children and dealing with adultery and revenge, and the story leads to the death even of several characters. The remaining characters try to pick up the pieces of their broken lives and teach a moral at the end that really teaches parents that they should be careful what they read and teach to their children, because fairy tales can lead to unrealistic expectations. They can really disappoint children when they become adults. So better to tell them the brutal truth early on so they can get used to it. So we give them loads of cop and detective shows on TV instead, where truly evil and perverse things are described in detail for 45 minutes, and then in the last 15 minutes of the show, the guilty parties are brought to justice. Or in the sitcoms, the bad guys are actually the lead characters, and we root for them to get away with the adultery or the fornication or the stealing, lying, deceit, and manipulation that they do, because the leads are all our friends. Or they're maybe nerds that we relate to. Or they come from the wrong side of town. Or they like kittens. Or they... Well, you get the idea. I'm going to spend some time with G.K. Chesterton today on fairy tales. I think his understanding of them is much, much better and much more nuanced. At one point he says, "Art is like morals. You have to draw the line somewhere." And fairy tales are a kind of art that deals with morals. So in fairy tales, lines are drawn in order to clarify and convey something very important. And the thing it's conveying is not pie-in-the-sky, imagined reality, escapist reality. It's reality as it really is. That's right. The fairy tales don't give us a false picture of reality that needs to be grown out of as we become adults. Fairy tales depict a reality that we've forgotten, that we've lost sight of in the ongoing fiction that we call adult life. It reminds me of a little of T.S. Eliot's poetry, where he talks about the fact that we've forgotten that we have forgotten things. So we don't know something, we've forgotten it, but then we've forgotten that we've forgotten it, so we don't even notice that it's gone. And he also says, at one point in the Four Quartets, we are distracted from distraction by distraction. And what we're distracted from, of course, is this reality I'm talking about. Children like fairy tales because they still see the reality. They still know that reality is magical. Perhaps fairy tales are for the purpose of reminding us that reality is truly weird and magical. Chesterton likes to talk about repetition. He says, we assume that the repetition of seasons, the daily rising of the sun, the regular grind of birth, life, death, these things are necessary events. And they're going to happen whether we like them or not. There's nothing we can do to stop them. There's nothing special about them, frankly. Flowers always come up in the spring. Birds always fly south in the winter. The sun always rises in the east. Day follows day. Season follows season. Each generation passes, and another takes its place. It's the boring grind of life. But in Orthodoxy, his great book Orthodoxy, Chesterton suggests that we have become dull to the wonders of this world. He talks about how a small child loves to be picked up and flipped over and put back down again. An adult does it once and the child laughs, and then the child says, what? Right, he says, do it again, Uncle John. Okay, I do it again, and he wants a third time, and a fourth. Well, by the fifth time, I'm tired of the game. But he'll never tire of it. The repetition becomes dull to me, boring. But to the child, the repetition is the fun. He doesn't think it boring at all to do the same thing over and over again. He gets as much fun out of it the tenth time as he did the first. Chesterton then suggests that repetition is not inherently boring. It is that we are too dull to enjoy it like a young child does. Perhaps God is like the young child enjoying sunrises and seasons and spring flowers so much that he says, do it again, and delights in it every time. I like daisies. Make some more. I like the sunrise. Do it again. Chesterton says, we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. Chesterton also says that the purpose of fairy tales is to always remember that the world is magical. In fairy tales, impossible things happen. Princes become bears, or pumpkins become carriages. But in reality, nothing like that ever happens, right? Wrong. In reality, eggs become chickens, and trees produce apples. In a fairy tale, you plant a magic bean and get a gigantic beanstalk, but in reality, you plant a kernel of corn and get an ear of corn with hundreds of kernels. Which one of those is more astonishing? If all you ever knew were eggs, how in a million years would you ever predict a chicken? The only reason it doesn't seem magical to us is the repetition of it. It happens the same way, all the time, predictable as clockwork. So we forget that the relation is far more improbable than a prince becoming a bear. We've seen princes that act like bears, Chesterton says. Who has seen an egg resemble in any way a chicken, or an apple blossom an apple? Reality is freaky weird if you stop and look at it. It's far stranger than fairy tales. And this is what the fairy tale does. It reminds us to be astonished. Chesterton says, these tales say that apples were golden only to refresh the forgotten moment when we found that they were green. They make rivers run with wine only to make us remember for one wild moment that they run with water. And again he says, all that we call common sense and rationality and practicality and positivism only means that for certain dead levels of our life, we forget that we have forgotten. All that we call spirit and art and ecstasy only means that for one awful moment, we have remembered that we have forgotten. There have been a lot of movies about memory in the last 20, 30 years. The lead character seems to always lose his memory, and with it, he becomes less of himself. He forgets who his loves are. He forgets his family, his work, his friends. And the main plot line becomes then how to get his memory and his life, basically, back. Think of Paycheck or The Bourne Identity. Or my favorite is Dory in Finding Nemo. My wife says, finally a character that's based on me. Memory is essential to our lives as believers. Remember the last words that Moses gives the Israelites before they go into the promised land? A land he knew that he would not be allowed to see. He tells them to remember. When you get into the land, you'll find houses you didn't build and wells you didn't dig and crops that you didn't plant. That's when you need to be careful, because you'll be tempted to forget God and what he's done for you. Always remember, Moses said, what the Lord has done for you, sustaining you in the desert, giving you his commandments, leading you here. Remember, remember, remember. A people who have forgotten who they are need to be reminded regularly. And this is the state we're in. And this is what fairy tales are about. Not to give a false saccharine picture of life as an escape from reality, but to wake up out of our cold slumbers so that we might always see the world and our lives as something extremely valuable, magical, even awful. Tolkien, you know, was accused of writing escapist literature, and instead of denying the fact, he embraced it. But said that there are two kinds of escape, you know, escaping from reality into false reality, or escaping from prison into freedom. And he said his books, especially The Lord of the Rings, are the second kind of escape. He sees The Lord of the Rings as escape from a prison of lies and evil into a world where the truth reigns. Good and evil are clearly defined, and the good is depicted so beautifully that you prefer it to evil. What is it that beauty does for us? How do we think beauty fits into God's design for His creation? The scriptures reflect something about it. Psalm 24:7 says that David longs for one thing. Do you remember what it is? To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. So we know that God is beautiful and will be the satisfaction of our desire for beauty. And that means that beauty in this world has to be some kind of a reflection of the beauty of God in some way, even if we can't put our fingers directly on the defining elements. But it also should follow that God would reveal Himself as beautiful. He does so through His revelation, both in the scriptures and in the world. Special and general revelation, we say. Special in that He gives us beautiful stories, elegant poetry, masterful parables, analogies, metaphors, similes, and songs all throughout the Bible. General in that He gives us sunsets, mountains, canyons, flowers, fish, good food, birds, as well as the talents to make our own beauty through craft, through art, which not only makes our lives more comfortable, but delights our souls. Because we long for beauty, it's our longing for God that is manifest in our longing for beauty. So how do we perceive this beauty? Well, by our senses, but also by metaphoric connection. The flower or the mountain range or the piece of music moves our hearts with their beauty, but I think that the experience of the beauty is the maybe unconscious connection that we make between the beautiful object and the beautiful creator of that object, God Himself. In that case, beauty in this world has the ability to draw us toward Him. And doesn't that make sense? That's what He would do, is want to draw us to Him and uses beauty to accomplish it. Jonathan Edwards wrote a masterful essay on the nature of true virtue. And he makes these kinds of connections. I want to read you a somewhat extensive part of his treatise. This is quoting Edwards. The reason, or at least one reason, why God has made this kind of mutual agreement of things beautiful and grateful to those intelligent beings that perceive it, probably is that there is in it some image of the true spiritual original beauty which has been spoken of, consisting in being's consent to being. Let me stop here and just say, he's making reference to two things in the previous chapters of this essay that we haven't time to read about. But one of them is about mutual agreement of things. That is, he says harmony is this idea of a mutual agreement of disparate things. And you can study that in music. You can see it in how elements in a painting are arranged and so on. Mutual agreement of things, that is, they're kind of in compositional relationship to each other. They're different sizes, they're different shapes, and so on, but they fit together somehow, and that's what he means by mutual agreement of things. But then he also says, perceives as a true spiritual original beauty, which has been spoken of, consisting in being's consent to being, or the union of spiritual things in a mutual propensity and affection of heart. So he's talking about how there's a kind of harmony that comes about in our own hearts, too, when we perceive things that are beautiful. And there's a relationship, a kind of a harmonic mutual agreement between the thing we're looking at and the way we are in our hearts, in our souls. And the effect is on our souls. But then he says, the other is an image of this because by that uniformity, diverse things become, as it were, one, as it is in the cordial union, this cordial union. And it pleases God to observe analogy in his works, as is manifest, in fact, in innumerable instances, and especially in establishing inferior things with analogy to superior things. Thus, in how many instances has he formed brutes, that is, animals, in analogy with the nature of mankind, and plants in analogy to animals with respect to the manner of their generation and nutrition and so on. And also, so he has constituted the external world in analogy to the spiritual world in numberless instances, as might be shown, if it were necessary, and here were a proper place for it. Why such analogy in God's works pleases him, it's not needful now to inquire. It is sufficient that he makes an agreement of different things in their form, manner, measure, etc., to appear beautiful, because here is some image of a higher kind of agreement and consent of spiritual beings. It has pleased him to establish a law of nature, by virtue of which the uniformity and mutual correspondence of a beautiful plant and the respect which the various parts of a regular building seem to have one to another, and their agreement and union, and the consent or concord of the various notes of a melodious tune should appear beautiful, because therein is some image of the consent of mind of the different members of a society or system of intelligent beings sweetly united in a benevolent agreement of heart. And here, by the way, this is continuing with Edwards, I would further observe, probably it is with regard to this image or resemblance which secondary beauty has of true spiritual beauty, that is, the material world has an analogy to the spiritual reality, that God has so constituted nature that the presenting of this inferior beauty, that is, in the world or through art, especially in those kinds of it which have the greatest resemblance to the primary beauty, that is, God himself, as the harmony of sounds and the beauties of nature, have a tendency to assist those whose hearts are under the influence of a truly virtuous temper to dispose them to the exercises of divine love and enliven in them a sense of spiritual beauty. End quote. Now, if Edwards is right, he is sure that the metaphoric or allegorical relation of physical objects to spiritual realities is not only a delight to God, he seems to delight in doing that, but it's also a lesson to us to see through and not only at beautiful objects. Making this error, that is, seeing the object without seeing through it, will have the inevitable effect of idolization of the object, will make an idol of it. Or, more likely, we will live for the experience of beauty in ourselves. Beauty should lead to adoration of God. If it does, it would mean that virtuous people would appreciate beauty better than others, but it doesn't always seem to work that way, does it? Beauty and goodness don't seem to line up one-to-one in our lives. Why is that, I wonder? Well, Edwards talks about that too. Here he says, quote, though it be true that there is some analogy in it to spiritual and virtuous beauty, as far as material things can have analogy to things spiritual, of which they can have no more than a shadow, yet, as has been observed, men do not approve it because of any such analogy perceived. Men don't necessarily see the analogy and then approve of it simply because of the analogy, he's saying. Back to Edwards. And not only reason, but experience plainly shows that men's appropriation of this sort of beauty does not spring from any virtuous temper and has no connection with virtue. For otherwise, their delight in the beauty of squares and cubes and regular polygons, in the regularity of buildings and the beautiful figures in a piece of embroidery, would increase in proportion to men's virtue. And it would be raised to a great height in some eminently virtuous or holy men, but would be almost wholly lost in some others that are very vicious and lewd. It is evident, in fact, that a relish of these things does not depend on general benevolence or any benevolence at all to any being whatsoever, any more than a man's loving the taste of honey or his being pleased with the smell of a rose. And that's the end of the quote. So what we learn is that there really isn't a one-to-one correspondence between the good and the beautiful, and that some men are very good indeed, but have little appreciation for the beautiful. But there are some men who commit the most awful acts, but love to listen to opera and read John Donne. So what is beauty in God's economy? Well, God uses beauty to draw us to Him. We are to see beauty in material objects as a means to this further end, and not as an end in themselves. He makes the creation itself beautiful and makes us able to perceive this beauty for one reason only, the same reason He does anything, to bring glory to Himself. This is not at all self-absorbed. He really is the best thing that ever happened to us. He is God's gift to us. And since by way of His creation we get to know Him, by extension we get to know artists by their way of art, which is a kind of imitation, isn't it? And imitation, they say, is the sincerest form of flattery. One last thing about fairy tales. They tell the truth in another way, too. In the fairy world, magic happens, but the magic usually hangs on one little provision. Chesterton talks about this in Orthodoxy again. The world will be okay as long as you don't open the box. And if you open the box, pandemonium will erupt. Pandemonium. You have to be loved before the last petal falls from the rose, we're told in fairy tales. The girl has to guess Rumpelstiltskin's name, or she'll lose her child. You can go to the ball as long as you get back before midnight, or the coach is going to turn into a pumpkin. You can eat any fruit you like, except for the fruit of one tree, or death will enter the world. You see, reality really is like a fairy tale. Everything makes sense as long as you obey the one thing that seems arbitrary at the moment. And so wisdom is to learn to listen to God and obey Him, and then find out why He asked you to do it. And that requires faith. And that's why it's only by faith that you're saved. Well, thank you for listening. This is John Hodges at the Center for Western Studies. And we hope that you will go back and look at fairy tales. Take a look at Grimm's fairy tales, for example, and see what it is that they really do teach. Don't just leave it to the guys at Disney to interpret those fairy tales for you. They're quite different sometimes than you know them, if you haven't actually read the originals. And continue to look into the other arts for the same reason, because fairy tales offer you a picture that is similar to what you can get from music and other poetry and novels and paintings and architecture. And it's in knowing those works that we've inherited as a culture. It's in those that we learn the wisdom of the past. It's in those that we see the accumulated, gathered results of trial and error of our ancestors. What we've got is an accumulation of the very best of the past. And since we can't see into the future, the best way to get outside of our own day, as C.S. Lewis would tell us, is to read old books. Before we go, I want to leave you with one suggestion for reading, if you're interested in what we've been reading lately. There's an old book by Thomas Howard. When I say old, I mean maybe it's 1976. Oh, it's an ancient book called Splendor in the Ordinary. And it's published by Tyndale House in this country and Coverdale House in England. I think it's in a different title in Coverdale's version. I think it's called As For Me and My House. But Splendor in the Ordinary is the title that I think Tyndale House gave it. And it's brilliant. It's a very simple book about how it is that we design our houses and why. And each room in the house is discussed. He talks about doors right off the bat. He talks about what you find inside the doors, the greeting place, the vestibule where you meet people, where you invite people in. He talks about the other places in the house, the dining room and the kitchen and the bedrooms and the bathrooms and so on. And why we have a living room and why we live there, why we need to invite people further into our houses from the vestibule. And what it means to use those rooms in a way that is hospitable. How is it that you use your house to offer Christian hospitality to your brothers and sisters, to your neighbors, to strangers that come in need? At any rate, Splendor in the Ordinary, that's the name of the book. Thomas Howard. Thomas Howard, you may remember, is Elizabeth Elliot's brother. And he's written quite a number of books, but this one always has stuck with me as one worthwhile. And it's in keeping with this idea of the transition between the material world and the supernatural, the spiritual world, and the way in which we can use material in an artistic way to glorify God and to show the beauty of hospitality in this case, and in the character and holiness of God. So, God bless you all. I hope you all have a great week, and I will see you again next time. This is From the Center, and I'm John Hodges.